This one, we people ask us to do a wartime home. So we've collected this to try to represent the sort of things that were available during the war years. The little guy here looking at his Meccano car.
Now that car is great.
Yeah, this guy made it for us. He was a bit of a Meccano connoisseur, and he said, I'll make you one, Ralph, out of the colours as used in the late 30s and early 40s. So that's the sort of the colour scheme of the car from that period. But this one, when we bought him, he was a little coloured lad.
Mm.
Now, we were not colour prejudiced, but he didn't fit in.
Right, right.
And so Daphne, bless her heart, she paints him. Painted him. He looks good.
No, he looks great. Perfect position down on his knees, look like a typical kid.
Yeah. No, so many people say, oh, I'm glad you had this, it's reminded me of so much. The little glasses, six glasses and the decanter, and the little tray, that was given to my parents by two Americans from here, Christmas of 1943. And Mum started to use them, but they were very cheap, you know, that's not criticising. But that little pattern, I think it was supposed to be a cockerel. Well, you put that on a glass, I don't know. But if you use it, it washed off.
Oh.
And so Mum vowed she would never do that, so she just used to keep it as a showpiece. And then when, well, she finally passed away, and my brother said to me, you being the 40s nut, you better have it. And of course, as soon as we got that, the first thing I thought of was to put it here. So that was my parents, this was my grandparents, the crockery here, and this was all, oh, there's a knife gone from there.
Uh-oh.
That was, well, they are really collector's items, but they fit so well in what we're trying to portray
right
here. This was another request of the Americans. Do us a little pub, Ralph.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's what he, well, no, it's one of their bulbs had gone out. So this is the guy they called the Spiv. He was the one who was working in the black market. He could get anything you want.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I
want
see
to buy a watch. Yeah, I usually tell a little story here. A load of nonsense. But the little innocent maiden here. They usually say if there was such a thing at that time. But anyway, the little innocent girl, she's been conned into buying a pair of stockings off of this wise guy. Lady about here, lady about town, knows all the answers, all done up in her finery,
yeah,
looking down her nose and saying to you, why don't you get yourself a yank, dear? You'll get your stockings for free then. And the dear old Salvation Army lady, looking all very pretty sour-faced and surprised at the goings-on here. And the barmaid, totally surprised what's happening in her pub. Now, that's a complete load of nonsense, but you just...
The expressions pretty much fit, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. Again, our son, he's the cabinet maker one. He made us the little bar.
Oh, really?
He said, I'll make you a bar to go in your pub. And the local brewers, known as Charles Wells, I rang them up and they gave me that centre section with the old pumps on their genuine wartime pumps.
That's nice.
But it does what we want. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And of course, many of the pubs in the war years were little rooms, front room in somebody's house.
Okay.
They were not great big places as they are.
Yeah.
Now. Often didn't have pumps. They had to go in the little cellar at the back and turn the barrels on and bring it out in a jug and pour the glasses out.
Very interesting.
And this is our tribute to the Women's Land Army, the Land Girls. They used to work on the local farms. All the men were away at war. And so they formed the Land Army. We've got pictures of them.
Wow.
If they were not suitable for military service, they virtually had to join either the Land Girls, the Timber Corps, or work in a factory. And many of them liked the open air, fresh air of the countryside, so they joined the Women's Land Army. These are typical of their uniforms. Well, they are examples of the uniforms they used to wear.
So what was being grown? No doubt barley, because they're still making beer.
Making beer, and of course that was the wheat and stuff for the bread. Not the corn like you, the wheat,
right.
You know. And of course they grew a lot of potatoes. The stuff that was essential to hopefully help feed the nation. Well, this was a lot of the guys that came over here. They were familiar with the farming things that one did, and so of course, being and all our fields were somewhere in the country, it gave them an interest. And a lot of them did used to go in their spare time. They used to work on the local farms, helping the farmers, you know, because really that was one time when. If you was on the same side, you all pulled together
right.
In any way you could.
Yeah, if you had some spare time, why not? Better than sitting around playing cards.
That little boy represents an evacuee. He's just come down from the big city.
Okay, and they were housed by local families to the degree they could?
Yeah, they picked on them. They were told, you know, you have the room and you'll have three evacuees or whatever. That little chap, Daphne, says he's been in the countryside long enough now, we ought to put some colour in his cheeks.
Yeah, I think so.
He wouldn't look so much like an evacuee then.
Yeah, I spent too many hours in the tube with that kind of colour.
Yeah. Friend of ours did sort of the back.
A little merle there. That's nice.
It's nice.
And a bird on the jug. Very cute.
Well, when we have the schools coming around, I questioned them a bit afterwards, and I said, did anybody like notice my little friend? And then, of course, some of the bright little ones said, is your little friend a little robin sitting on the jug? I said, yeah, that's it, you've got it. You should give them something then. There's one for putting on a Christmas cake, really. But he does the job here, and he doesn't fly away, which is fun. That's a baby's gas mask. See the baby in it? Well, it's got a doll in it.
Wow, never heard of that.
Yeah, you had to put the baby in complete and then operate the air through this
hand pump,
filtered pump. And then the next stage was the one with the two circular windows, as I call them. They used to call that the Mickey Mouse. That you could persuade kids to wear it if you told them they looked like Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
So they become, and then this became the standard respirator for the civilians, the one at the back there.
You didn't get too much in the countryside, right?
Well, we didn't get too much gas, thank goodness.
Right, but I mean, this looks like it would be something that complicated that you wouldn't see
one
out here.
Well, Daphne's sister was putting one.
Really?
And she just wouldn't stop screaming, apparently.
Yeah, I
can
imagine.
Which is understandable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think that's a lovely painting.
This one here?
Yeah, with the detail on it. No, nothing more, really, but... I mean, look at the detail in that little French village, apparently. That's supposed to be the D-Day beaches in the background.
Oh, okay.
And these two jugs flying over the top. I still think it's a lovely painting.
Were there a lot of trucks? They must have been driving trucks with the bombs. I mean, that must have been omnipresent.
Yeah. A lot of the bombs, although they had the bomb dumps on the base, a lot of them were stored out in the countryside to disperse them. And, of course, you camouflage them with trees. And they were in, like, little Quonset huts, not so they stood up too high. They used to put them under those, and they were all camouflaged. And then they used to bring them in all sorts of vehicles onto the base, store them here ready for the next morning, and then take them from here out to the aircraft. And I got a picture somewhere. It shows the big brick company around here was called London Brick Company, big red wagons. And they used to use those to bring the bombs from the country roads onto the airfield here. Got a little video, and it shows the London Brick Company lorries coming in with all the bombs stacked on the back.
Must have been a lot of noise. I mean, this must have been going all the time.
Because, of course, I mean, we had this, we had Poddington, we had Chelveston, all within a few miles of here. And then we had the place at Twin Woods, which was an operational training base. And then just down the road, we had Little Staunton. Now, that was a British Pathfinder base. They used to fly Lancasters and Mosquitoes from there. And a lot of the guys from here said when they first came across it, said, we wonder what the hell was coming towards us. They took off. They were all in daylight, of course, flying across to Europe. And there was all these bombers coming back, Pathfinders and so forth. But they didn't fly in formation. So you had a black dot here and a black dot there. And they got used to it, but they said it was very frightening initially. See all these things, initially black specks, coming towards them. And it was the same all around the countryside, you know.
Did they do all this in daytime? Did the trains, when people were coming back and forth to London or wherever, did they run the trains in the daytime, or did all that run at night?
No, trains ran in the daytime.
Any old time.
Yeah, all the time, yeah.
But yeah. Blackout, nevertheless.
Oh, no, everything was done in the blackout, yeah.
At night.
I mean, you had the lights with this little slits on the cars. Yeah, and then yeah, this is a typical little lamp here, a cycle lamp. But you had a shield on it, and it just forced a little bit of light down below.
Oh, yeah.
And there's some in that hut over there, I think. Even the bicycles, you know. You
right.
And they'll hopefully find your way in the dark.
Oh, yeah. How big was Bedford? How many people?
Can't tell you offhand, but it was one hell of a lot smaller than it is now.
Right.
It was developed tremendously after the war. I can't tell you equivalent figures.
Yeah.
But by going out to some of the roads on the X, on the outside of the town, you know, when I was a kid, it all used to be countryside. Now it's all built up. I can't really answer your question, yeah. But
Thurlow looks like it probably hasn't changed a whole lot.
Quite a few more houses built there. But in broad terms, it hasn't changed a lot. Well, this one, now this little bit here, Eric Smith, now he was 3.5 years a prisoner of the Japanese. This is the only association with Thurlow was his wife, that eventually became his wife, used to be superintendent of one of the land girl hostels where all these girls used to be, and that was down at Milton Ernest. And we got to know Mary, and then we got to know Eric, and then he started telling us about it. He said, of course, I didn't see too much of it. I was 3.5 years as a prisoner of the Japs. And then he loaned me his story he'd written. And he had an atrocious time.
Oh,
and by the end of the war, he said, we literally did wear those bits of rag pulled through the leg, as you see on many pictures. He said, we didn't have any footwear, we didn't have anything. We made out any old bits of rubber tyre, strapped them to the feet. And he said it was awful, and they treated us like pigs, a little bit of rice occasionally. And then when the war, it was, they didn't know anything. They were in a prison camp in a jungle clearing. And then he said, suddenly all the Japanese guards just disappeared. So somebody realised, well, they all realised something was happening. They knew the end of the war was fairly imminent. And they said, Eric said, we couldn't do much because we didn't know where we were and we didn't know where to go. And then one day, 3 B-29s flew over the top. Super fortresses, you know, flew over the top. He said, and we all went mad. We were so weak, we couldn't do much, trying to wave and shout. And these three aircraft just continued. And then after about an hour, they came back. But when they came back, the bomb doors were open, the bomb bay was open. And of course their first thoughts, oh Christ, they think we're Japanese. But when, as they got over the top, things started dropping, and they were dropping clothing out to them because they just, this is an American combat jacket, as you can see.
Yeah.
And this is one that Eric had. He said most of the other stuff is used for gardening. They dropped the mess tins because they didn't have anything to eat from, and water bottles. They were all dropped from these planes. Anyway, they eventually got released, and on their way back to England, they went via Canada for some reason. I don't know why. When they got to Canada, the Canadians still took pity on these bedraggled characters, and they gave them each some Canadian uniforms. Well, if you look at these have got RCAF on the buttons.
Huh.
Royal Canadian Air Force. And these were some of Eric's things And he said, would you like them for the museum? He said, it's nothing to do with the 306, but there's this slight connection. The wife was here, and so we put that little group there. That's Eric from his time, 3.5 years as a prisoner of the Japs. This is a folding bicycle.
Oh, yeah.
That the commandos or the parachuters used under those wing nuts and fold it in half. So you could drop from the air on a parachute with it. Or wade ashore, as the commandos did.
I'll bet those aren't that light, but nevertheless.
No, they're heavy old frames.
Actually. Yeah.
But nevertheless, by folding them, it made them easier to. And then just swing them around, put the chain on, and get to hell out of it, as they say.
Airborne. Parachute.
Yeah. Pegasus.
Oh, okay.
Pegasus. Home front stuff, and this is the money for the kids.
Oh, yeah.
Wartime money, you know. And they are big, those pennies.
Right.
240 of those are pretty weighty things.
Make at least a pound, maybe more. Maybe quite a bit more.
Yeah. That was prisoner of war money. That was mainly printed for the Italian prisoners. Once Italy capitulated, it was pretty early on, as you know. Well, it was a system of bartering within the prison camp. Because, of course, they used a lot of the Italians because they were pretty good workers. They were terrible fighters. You know, they always laugh and they used to say over here they had one forward and four reverse gears on their tanks. So they could go faster backwards than forwards. And they worked on the local farms, a lot of them. That was given to me. It was in a little rusty tin. That's why it got.
Yeah, they got the little rust things on it.
On them. But nonetheless, they're genuine things of that time and those terrible times, really.
Right. Needless to say.
Yeah. But as I say, we're still in touch with the family of that prisoner of war. Was Italian. He and Pina, his wife, have both passed on. But he had some lovely holidays, and they were right in northern Italy, right in the foothills of the Alps, Italian side, obviously. And we just had some wonderful holidays up there. Great food, great drink, and companionship. It was just wonderful.
These Italians were captured.
They
were Italian army.
Yeah.
They captured after the capitulation or before?
No, before Renzo.
So they were still enemy army.
Well, they were enemy army, but so many of them hated both Hitler and in particular Mussolini that led them into this war.
Right.
So they were very anti the hierarchy of the Nazi sort of.
So how did they get here?
Well, once they were prisoners, they were brought over. They had hundreds of prison camps in this country for them.
Really? Now yeah. That's something you don't hear a lot about.
Yeah, they had hundreds. But they used to do, they were such artistic guys. I mean, from the simple things of making little rings and things. And that was made by an Italian prisoner, that cigarette case here.
Really?
And in the detail, and you didn't have many tools to do it.
No kidding.
They were just beautiful, really. And then they started coming out on the local farms. Used to bring them out each morning in a military truck. Initially, they had guards with them. But then when they capitulated, they let the Italians... They brought them out each day and took them back at night. And then as time went on, they were allowed to go out if they were not required for work at weekends. They could not stay out overnight, but they could go out to a family and spend the day with them. That's how we came to know this guy, Renzo Zanotti. He worked on a local farm, yes, but then he used to come out and spend the weekend. They had to go back every night, but my dad used to take him back in his little Austin 7 car. And that's how this friendship developed, which is still going on today.
Well, I'm surprised that the government wanted, or the army wanted, to bring all those people this far just to put them in prison camps, but I guess they figured they'd work.
Well, they did. Well, they had them working, particularly the Italians.
Right.
Well, and the Germans, eventually. They were working on local farms. But the Italians just became so... Well, they didn't want to fight.
Right.
They didn't want to fight in the first place.
Right.
And so if they were being looked after and they knew their families were still safe back in Italy. But we used to go over there, and he lived, as I say, in the foothills of the Alps. And I used to go up with Renzo in particular, up in the mountains. And he took me to lots of memorials where the partisans, the Italians that were fighting against the Germans. And it was wonderful, some of the vantage points they had, where the roads, you know, they wind up the mountains. And of course, as he said, they were, I don't know whether he used the term, they were sitting ducks.
Yeah.
For the Italians who were fighting against the Germans by this time. And then if some of them did get killed, there were little monuments all up this mountain. It was the most, it sounds crazy, but the most wonderful experience.
Yeah, it sounds.
And then we used to go around, we used to go to the shops, and I don't know what he used to say, but we never paid for anything.
Oh.
We got used to saying, well, what's that, Renzo? You know, because he spoke very good English. And he'd tell us, and by the time we got to leave the shop, it was all wrapped up. This is for you, your friend Renzo. You know, they were talking sort of pidgin English, but... It was just an Well, he always appreciated, he said, what my parents did for him when he was a prisoner. All right, by this time he was being allowed out a bit. But he was so gracious of what had happened.
That's a great story.
Yeah, it's a completely true one, I'm sure.
Now, you've put all these stories on tape for all of us.
Written down. I keep being told you must write a book. I have started, but whether I'll ever get it finished or not.
inoculation certificate?
Yeah, just a miscellany of bits and pieces.
Right.
Somebody came in one day and they said, "Ralph, we know you look after everything here. Would you like my uncle's World War One stuff?"
Oh, yeah.
That's all World War One. I said, "Well, I can't do that." They said, "You can, because we know it will be safe here." Different. I'll promise myself I'll record the names and put them all on them, because I got like a Bible of medals. I got them all, but I just haven't got round to doing it.
They're service cat medal
badges,
or something.
Cat badges or something like, or like this guy.
Okay, and that represents somebody's guard. His unit is.
That's the Royal Artillery. That.
Okay.
I don't know if we've got a separate one. Yeah, there's one there, a bit different colour. This thing. Yeah, they didn't do it so much, because a lot of the Americans say, I mean, they said, "We didn't know what the hell they were giving them for us. We knew we got them." Yeah, there's one or two unicorns with them on the side. Might be in a new position. Well, there's the British one.
Yeah. So some of this stuff.
That guy, you'll notice, he's got the 8th Air Force on one sleeve and the 9th on the other. Now, that was after the war, but he put it on because he was both in the 8th and the 9th Air Force at
different
times. You know.
What's the instrument behind the
That
the
was
shells?
An octant. That was a bit more updated than the sextant.
Okay.
That was from the film 12 O'Clock High. That particular jug, Toby jug they called it, was one of five used in the making of the film 12 O'Clock High.
How'd you end up with that?
One of the guys in the States went to a movie memorabilia sale, and he bought it, and we went to stay with him once when he was over there. He said, "I've been parceling this up for you. I'd like you to take it back for your museum." And so that's how we got that.
918 is 3 times 306.
306, yeah. It was the fictitious bomb group, the 918. Yeah, why 3 times 306, I do not know, but that's how they arrived at that figure. Oh, that banner in there, "Go Fightin' Bightin'," well, you read what it says. Well, it just says it was donated by Walt Rose. I think this is what makes our collection, I know I'm saying it, pretty unique because of this. Here's the Congressional Medal of Honor. That 368 office is very convenient.
Yeah.
Snaffy's medal. Well, the guy's got it for us in the States because his family, or well, it became a right. And they were pleased when he left the base. He only got four more missions in. This was on his first. He got four others, so he did five in total before they got rid of him. He was causing untold troubles.
Yeah.
And then even after the war, he came to the reunion once in America, and he got so drunk, he fell down the stairs in the hotel, and nobody would bother to pick him up. You know, he just annoyed people. Oh, yeah, well, he did a good job. I mean, it just went to his head somehow. That was being presented with Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, the civilian guy.
So here we have POW types.
Yeah, Lee Cashman and Bob Flood. Old Lee was captured fairly early on. But with a name like Kessler, the Germans wouldn't initially believe that he wasn't in any way connected to Germany. But he told me he didn't know it. All right, it seems as if it may have been named like Kessler. But he said he had no knowledge of it at all. But because they wanted to say he was, they stuck him in solitary confinement for a long, long time in a little 6-foot cell, but they took every item of clothing away from him. And he said, you may not think it bothered you too much because nobody saw you, because you used to stuff food, as it were. But he said it just had a profound effect on his life. And when he first met Peg, his wife, he said he couldn't act normal at all. It just completely, and right up to his death, he was a wonderful man, but somehow he just couldn't get this out of his head. And this was on one of the many marches as the war came to an end, and the column of Americans were marching one way, and a column of Hungarian Jews going off the other, looking their striped suits. And one of the guys fell in the roadside, and a German officer just went and shot him through the head. And Lee said, I just could not get that out of my mind. Why can't a man die with dignity? And so after the war, when he was recovering from TB, I think, or tuberculosis, I think it was, and he's a very good artist, and he decided he'd get this picture down. So Lee himself drew that. That is a copy of the original, which he gave us. The original is in a Jewish establishment somewhere in America. And, well, I think it's marvellous. And that's Lee's jacket. And this was some of the stuff he drew after the war.
Okay.
These were done on little bits of paper in the, he did them in prison camp. Lee did these after the war. This is what we call our area for quiet reflection. To date, because I'm loose leaf, we've got 800 and something names of those that were killed in combat. Daphne did all this, the typing, but they're loose leaf, so we can add to it if we need to.
Right.
And it's much respected by people. The candles give up, they keep bending. I don't know why. And that, of course, came from Wendover Field, way up in the Utah desert. Yeah, with the 306 first train. We went up to see it. We got there and they got a little museum there. Yeah, we got there and it was fairly late one evening. There's still a little airfield there. And we were talking, and one of the guys in the little museum, he said, "Well, you don't come from these parts. What the hell are you doing in a godforsaken hole like this?" That was his words. And I said, "Well, I'm actually the British rep of the 306 bomb group." And he said, "Good gracious, I'll tell the others." He said, "You realise they were the first people to train here." And that went on, and I said, "Well, we'll have to leave you because you're wanting to close." He said, "We'll stay open all night now you're here." One of the original commanding officers here, or over there, said Wendover was a town of 40 inhabitants, one tree, five blades of grass and the State Line Hotel. He said it was just the most godforsaken hole on earth. And the guide said, "Well, it's no good going AWOL because there was just nowhere to go. You've got the salt flats and the mountains and the desert and just nothing there." Well, the King and Queen and their current Queen, when she was Princess Elizabeth. And Colonel Robinson decided, well, he thought it would be too much of a propaganda coup if Princess Elizabeth were to get shot down. So he asked around the base for ideas of names, and the crew chief of this aeroplane, Ed Gregory, he came up with the idea of Rosa York. They settled on that, and then he made the right noises, and the King, Queen and the Princess came to Thurlow to christen the aeroplane, and Jimmy had to be there, being a big ace. And this is the christening material in the bag. They attached a metal plate to the two chin turret guns. And there's the Princess, just breaking it on the plate. Now, there's no doubt they christened it with English cider. But there were two stories as to why they christened it with English cider. One simply says there's a war on, they couldn't get champagne. The other one says they managed to acquire a bottle of Chambers, but the Queen Mum, who was known to like a tipper or two, she says, "Well, why don't we toast the crew with the champagne and christen the aeroplane with English cider?" Take your pick, but I think the second one is probably true, because apparently she loved a tipper. So that's no nice pictures.
I guess they recycled all that brass.
Used to dump it in the ditches around the countryside. And we as kids used to find some of it.